Konni. Comrade Konni, the workers want your intervention.
Take the seat, please.
Can I call this meeting to order? Let me begin by introducing the subject of today and how we're going to deal with it. And you will know that you have very thick files with various documents. You would note that we have a very clear program which program we will be managing as chairs of both the NCOP and the National Assembly of the committees mentioned. But in welcoming you, let me begin by recognize, I know she's on the way, the Honorable Chairperson or Honorable Oliphant, House Chair on International Relations, House Chair, Honorable Babu Skosana, who's also a member of the Committee on International Relations, Honorable Farbs, Chairperson of Trade and Industry, Honorable Kamede, the Chair of the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations, Honorable Fukeng, the Chair of the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development, the Honorable Members from the different committees of both the NA and NCOP, the representatives of DECO, representatives from the Department of Justice, our resource person from the UCT, the parliamentary support staff, and ladies and gentlemen, it's with great sense of honor and humility that I welcome you to this very important workshop to deal with the treaty. A topic very close to the hearts of many of us represented here today. I extend also my gratitude to our resource person, Salim from the UCT and Sidia from DECO, who will generate a robust debate for these committees relating to the treaty-making process. Our International Relations Committee is of the opinion that South Africa's role in the negotiation of treaties and of the domestic implementation of treaty obligations has aroused considerable interest in Parliament, in the general community, including business and other non-governmental organizations. It is indeed the wish of all of us here, or who are gathered here, to have a deep and a clear understanding of the processes involved in treaty making in the country. It became imperative therefore, that we invite other committees whose work involves dealing with the multitude of treaties which require ratification by Parliament. You would understand that the final step of these committees, I mean of these treaties, will also have to go to the NCOP. Hence, these two committees are also stakeholders here. On trade and industry, you know that there are a lot of treaties or arguments which are being started. We started talking about this with Honorable Fass as early as last year, when we're looking at how things are done. Sometimes when a treaty would just be dropped and then it said it must go through Parliament, and you find that it's 5 or 6 or 3 years old, and you ask the question, where was it all along? When we were in Uganda, I think 2 months ago, in the PAP meeting, being challenged about the 2007 AU Charter on democracy elections, I mean governance elections and democracy, which was signed by the heads of state in 2007, but not yet effective or enforced, because it does not have 15 countries, which is the minimum, needed to sign it or needed to ratify it in their own parliament, as only 5 have just signed it. And we're found wanting, even us as South Africa. Because that has not yet been ratified, although the president of the country has signed. Honorable members, the key objectives targeted through this workshop are to explore the options for early involvement of Parliament in treaty-making processes in South Africa. We discuss the modalities for enhancing current mechanisms for scrutinizing treaties and enhance oversight on the implementation of these treaties. It can't be that we sign, we forget about that treaty. You may have observed, honorable members, that internationally, the 20th century has brought about many global changes and multilateral cooperation. Nations are interdependent, and international organizations have become platforms where governments adopt decisions and treaties. It's an interesting fact that for most of these treaties, the majority of parliamentarians are not consulted during negotiations. Consequently, parliaments have taken the resolve to step beyond the traditional executive prerogative in international treaties, especially with treaties, and subject government to the same degree of oversight as in the domestic policy area. Why do we have to sign a lot of these treaties, but we don't have any oversight on them? The implications of these developments to democracy are very clear. Majority of the decisions that matter to the lives of the country's citizens, including their security, are taken beyond the national borders or by the international institutions that are not subject to any national democratic control or accountability. As I was following the AU summit in Uganda, when there were these appeals to South Africa to send the troops to Somalia, I was saying, where is this matter going to be debated? I was asking myself, I'm not sure what are the procedures and so on. As Parliament, are we going to have to support it, having not had the motivation? So in Parliament, we need to ensure that greater dialogue on treaties that South Africa will enter into is very important. The Parliament must assess its role and level of involvement in treaty-making process. I'm saying, honourable members, it must be clearly understood, however, that Parliament is very clear on its constitutional mandate. It is not by any means laying claim to a negotiating mandate, nor seeking one. And I want to emphasize, it remains the task of the executive to negotiate in the international arena, to clear in the constitution. However, Parliament must be able to scrutinize these negotiations by being kept fully informed as they unfold and having an opportunity to express to the executive their political views. That's the center of our debate. It can't be just have something endorsed. It will be recalled that the first conference of the presiding officer of Parliament, which was held under the auspices of the Inter-Parliamentary Union at the UN in 2000, in its declaration, outlined what involvement of Parliament in the international affairs, including treaties, which may be extended to, and I quote, influencing their country's policy on matters dealt with in the United Nations and other international negotiation forums, keeping themselves informed of progress and outcome of these negotiations, deciding on ratification where constitution so foresees of the text and the treaties signed by government. And I want to emphasize the text and treaties, contributing actively to subsequent implementation processes, unquote. This was the reaffirmation by the inter-parliamentary body that Parliament must claim their role in treaty-making processes. Cannot be rubber stamped. Must claim your role. Honourable members, it will be recalled that since the fourth Parliament started functioning, it was made very clear since 1994 as Parliament had been largely engaged with the onerous task of revising and or repealing of the oppressive laws to put in place laws consistent with the spirit of the current and the democratic constitution. That's what has been happening all along. The challenge currently facing Parliament is that there's not been much focus and adequate processing nor proper engagement with the executive with regard to international treaties and processes building up to South Africa becoming a party to any of the treaties. It is with the above reasons, then, or reasons in mind, that the committee resolved to organize an all-encompassing workshop for Parliament to engage holistically with treaties and how oversight can be enhanced. I guess the Department of International Relations and Justice, they will brief the workshop on the current practice with regard to treaty-making process in South Africa. As the committee, we have engaged Salim, who is a senior lecturer at UCT in the public law, to make a presentation on the options Parliament may have under the existing constitutional provision to increase its involvement and enhance its oversight strategy for treaties in South Africa. Let me conclude, honourable members, by saying there are four questions. Where are the four questions? There are four questions which we should keep at the back of our mind, which will guide us in our deliberation towards our stated objective. Okay. He's gonna flesh them, but let me just continue. The questions are What option does Parliament have for early involvement in negotiation process of treaty before they are tabled in Parliament for ratification? How do we enhance the Parliament's capacity to scrutinize treaties? Is the current practice of an accompanying explanatory memorandum adequate to inform Parliament on all elements relating to the treaty? Sometimes these treaties are challenging us that we have to review our legislation. I'm not sure if we've been doing it. How do we fast track legislation to give effect to treaty obligations? How do we enhance Parliament's capacity to have effective oversight on the subsequent implementation of treaties after they have been ratified and domesticated? Because these are not on the slide, on the small telescope. See, we belong to the age of the telescope, not of the movie. This is like a telescope. Yes. The most popular telescope to us was the one brought by, in a truck by Omo. Let me just repeat this question. What option does Parliament have for early involvement in negotiation processes of treaties before they are tabled in Parliament for ratification? How do we enhance the Parliament's capacity to scrutinize the treaties? So that we don't just rather step. We must scrutinize that. Is the current practice of an accompanying explanatory memorandum adequate to inform Parliament on all essential elements relating to the treaty? How do we fast track legislation to give effect to treaty obligations? Effective oversight on the subsequent implementation of treaties after they've been ratified and domesticated? I hope as we leave this workshop today, we will be empowered to understand these different types of treaties, whether signed or not, what has been signed, and their implications for the Republic of South Africa. So I now have the honor and privilege to declare this workshop officially open, and thank you for your attention. Let me also welcome the House Chair. I did recognize her in absentia, House Chair Oliphant on International Relations. Let me hand over to Honorable Fabs and Kamadi, who are going to be driving this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable. I don't know if we're calling each other these days at a workshop, Mr. Honourable, but I see it is in fact Honourable Nancy. Thank you. I think we all welcomed that introduction, because ideas that we may have shared on this were assisted in bringing us together to an element of pre-convergence before going into the workshop proper. I was looking to the staff members, support staff, to at least find out or give us some indication as to when we could expect Professor Salim. And then we know he's not here just at the moment, and we think it could be quite useful in the absence of perhaps people not having that question paper right in front of them, and I know you will be getting it right in front of you, that I do know, for us at this point to hand over to the department, because I can see the department is here. The department, let's have a look at you. Your equipment is set up, is it? Of course, it may be set up, is it working? Because we need to make sure it is working. And while we're waiting for that, because we all know how these things are, it's yesterday, and then we wait until the future. But I think it'll be a good idea as well if we can see all our honourable members of Parliament on one side, as we said earlier, so that there's a clear indication as to who the members of Parliament are, the presenters are, as well as the well, the department itself. So we've got it all ready? No, not yet. All right, let's just go back there. You've got a couple of other documents in front of you as well, but I would like to say one thing. Is that certainly Honourable Lacey actually, we mentioned this and he discussed this with me, but the reality is he has been driving the process. And certainly I think on the trade and industry side, and I'm sure on every other side, the Select Committee would agree with me, I'm sure, Honourable Gamedi, we really appreciate you taking those reins and driving the process forward, because treaties, as we all know, and any agreements, have a major impact on policy. And I'm sure we have in front of us at this moment, Mr. Salim, is it right? I wasn't sure if you were the Professor Salim I once knew, but then I see you're a much younger version. are you going to be using an overhead or not, or do you want to get your breath back? I think we all do, don't we? You've all got that in front of you, don't you? Yes. Well, nothing like looking at that now. Yes. Well, at least now, next time you had a dry run, it'll only take you 30 seconds to get started. Good idea. No, thank you for being ready. But we will hand over to Mr. Salim. All right. But now I think you know how our system works. Thanks. Right. Now, we're not going to be standing up here. This is a workshop. And I am, after all, only a co-chair here. And I'm going to be sitting down next to my co-chair, the Honourable Gamedi. So it may be preferable for you to come up here, because you probably know your presentation off by heart. You don't need to read it. And you're going to highlight critical issues. Won't you be highlighting the critical issues for us? Because this will be on the issues of the prospects. This was raised already. Enhancing parliamentary oversight of treaty making and implementation in South Africa. And I'm sure in that implementation, you'd be looking at the effects of some of that implementation, won't you? Won't you? Yes, we certainly would like to welcome you right into Parliament, but perhaps sit on that side now. That's fine. If you'd like, yes, or up here, if ever you find, I think it would be up there, would be preferable, right next to, we can get another chair up here. There we are, there's a chair. And even better still, I wonder if everyone can see Mr. Salim there, or would it be better here? Yeah, nice. They want to be present on the right, it's actually Mr. Salim Nakhjavani. I just didn't want to mispronounce the name.
It's a common concern, so
thank you.
So, Molweni manene na manene kazi, diavuya kuteta nani na mslanj. Gu Salim Nakhjavani, kumshoshi omkulu, akwisebe yedomteto a university yasekapa. With your permission, I'll address the joint committee meeting in English because it's the only official language of this beautiful country that I can actually work in, though I wanted to greet also in one of the African languages. I'd like to begin by thanking Honorable Plessy for his gracious invitation to address the Committee on International Relations and Cooperation last May, and also for his proposal that we convene this meeting, which is tremendously valuable. There is a wonderful opportunity in front of us to examine the ways in which South Africa's parliament can play a greater role as the voice of the people in enhancing its oversight of treaty making and implementation. In my paper, I don't propose any particular course of action, but I explore options. The reason for doing this is to defer to you as the representatives of the people to decide what is best. It's not for me to say that. It's for me to spell out what choices you may have in front of you so that you can make a decision that is informed. When we look at the South African constitutional landscape, we see that there is possibility that Parliament could play a greater role in how treaties are made by South Africa and implemented by South Africa in a way that respects the prerogatives of the executive branch of government. And that's what I propose in the paper. which you have in front of you. Now, the paper has a number of sections, and I will highlight the key elements. I was asked to speak for no more than 30 minutes, maybe I'll speak for less, highlighting key points, so that then there can be a discussion and consultation together. The first part of the paper just introduces some of the important concepts in international law that govern the operation of treaties, so that we can be sure that we are all speaking the same language and we understand the same terms. Then I examine the South African Constitution and its rules on treaty making and implementation, and finally look at the practice of parliaments in other countries to see if we can learn lessons or to gain ideas about how parliament could enhance the role that it plays now in the area of treaty making. We begin with a very fundamental point. The world is contracting into a village. The world is in some ways becoming already like one country, and all of us like its citizens. Treaties are the closest thing we have to international legislation. There are now, since the foundation of the United Nations in 1948, there are now some 54,000 treaties in force in the world, spelling out rules on international trade, on the conduct of diplomacy, on human rights, on security, defense, and countless other areas of human collaboration. There is no doubt that treaties are the workhorse of international law, in the words of another scholar, an indispensable tool of diplomacy and the most important instrument for regulating international affairs. Those of you who are familiar with the history of international law will know that in the time of our great-great-grandfathers, international law was mostly a matter of customary behavior between countries. Many of the rules were not written down. The rules were fluid and changing depending on the behavior of states, especially the behavior of powerful states. Treaty making allows all states to play a more equal part in the drafting of rules, because the rules are more certain and predictable and clear. They're written on paper. South Africa, as a regional powerhouse, as a regional leader, should be very interested in how treaties are made. Now, it's important at the outset to distinguish between multilateral and bilateral treaties. Sometimes there are problems of common concern, for example, in the area of the environment, where many states will come together and agree some basic rules. We would call these multilateral treaties. Other times, South Africa may enter into a two-way agreement with another country. Those are bilateral treaties. According to the Department of International Relations and Cooperation's website, and here I rely on publicly available information, I'm sure that the next speaker will perhaps be able to shed more light on this. But according to the public information I've been able to find, South Africa is now bound by 261 multilateral treaties and 1,694 bilateral treaties. Now, with that, I'm going to explore something about the international legal framework that governs the operation of treaties. Helpfully, the rules that tell us how a treaty should be made between countries, what happens if it's violated, who has the power to enter the treaties under international law, is all found in one document, the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which is itself a treaty. It's a treaty on treaties. And we learn some important facts by looking at this Vienna Convention. First, and it's an important point, when honorable members look at the long list of treaties which South Africa has entered, you will see that some are called Memorandum of Understanding, some are called Statute, Convention, Covenant, Exchange of Letters. Many different terms are used. Under international law, what is important is not the words that are used to describe the agreement, but the intention of the states that enter the agreement.
If it is an agreement where the states intend to create legal obligations, not only to make political undertakings or to smile at each other, that document is considered a treaty. It doesn't matter what the official title of the document is. Now I'll explore very briefly, because it is an area that particularly affects South Africa, the ways in which treaties are made under international law. For now, I'm not speaking about the South African Constitution. We can look at three basic stages: the negotiation of the treaty, its adoption and signature, the process of ratification or accession, leading to the entry into force of the treaty. Now, what happens during treaty negotiations is not known by people, humble people like me, because usually these negotiations happen behind closed doors. They're in secret. The South African people don't generally have a direct say in how the executive negotiates these agreements. But what will happen after the negotiation is that an authentic text will be adopted. The states will say, yes, this is what we've agreed to, and they will sign it. When a state signs a treaty, it's not like you and I signing a contract. When we sign a contract, unfortunately, we're stuck. We're bound. When we sign our lease or our car hire agreement, the signature creates legal obligations. Not so with treaties. States are very lucky. They get to go through a two-stage process. They say, first, we sign where we say we intend to take on these obligations in the future. When a state signs under international law, it has one obligation, an obligation not to defeat the object and purpose of the treaty. So hypothetically, if South Africa was to sign the statute creating the International Criminal Court, which it has done, and before it ratifies that statute, it decides to allow war criminals to live freely in the country without being prosecuted, maybe you could say South Africa is defeating the object and purpose of that treaty. But states allow themselves a period of time between signature and ratification. This period of time is very important because, especially when a treaty is complex, it's not enough for a state to simply say, yes, we agree. The state needs to adjust its domestic law, its own regulation. It needs to create new government positions to manage the affairs that will come up under that treaty. This takes time. In some countries, they need to consult with parliament. In other countries, they need parliamentary approval. All of this process takes time. So only when that process is complete is the treaty ratified. What happens then is that a state says, yes, now we are ready to take on all these legal obligations in the treaty. Now we are bound. Now, one of the questions that comes up, one of the questions I was asked to address is, when a state becomes bound by a treaty, are they giving up their sovereignty? There are many ways to look at this question. But one simple way of thinking of this is to say that to be bound by a treaty is an act of sovereignty. It's a free choice. The state is deciding to be bound, so it's exercising its sovereignty. It's not giving up its sovereignty. It's also free to withdraw from the treaty if it wishes to do so. Now, when honorable members look at the list of treaties which South Africa has entered, you will see that many of them don't have a date of ratification. Instead, it says date of accession. And this often causes confusion. What is the difference between ratification and accession? So with your permission, honorable members, I'll briefly look at this issue. In order to ratify a treaty, a state has to have signed it. In order to sign the treaty, a state has to do so during the period of time when the treaty is open for signature. What will usually happen is that the treaty text is adopted,
It will be placed there in a book. Representatives of states will come and sign on behalf of their state, and then they will say, right, this treaty is going to sit with the Secretary General of the United Nations. It will be open for signature until the 31st of December 2008, let's say. Now, what happened to South Africa? We all know the history of this country. Before the constitutional dispensation, the apartheid government was not a big fan of entering international treaties. It didn't want many of these legal obligations to do with human rights, for obvious reasons. So by the time of the democratic dispensation, a lot of very important treaties had been closed for signature. It was no longer possible to sign those treaties. The books had been closed. But those treaties allow states to join by accession, which is a slightly different procedure. So when you look at the treaties that South Africa entered, which were first created before 1994, you will often see that South Africa has acceded to them, not ratified them. The legal effect is the same. South Africa remains bound by the contents of those treaties from the time that it acceded to them. So I hope that's clear. Now, as someone who has come to South Africa only since 2006, it's not fitting that I lecture to you about the South African Constitution. I should learn from you about the South African Constitution. But so that we remind ourselves, and I was telling Honorable Nesti last time, I have 5-month-old twins, so by speaking about the South African Constitution to you, I'm practicing how to teach them also one day about the country that is their home, because they are South African citizens. It's important to remind ourselves of the contents of Section 231 of the Constitution, just as a refresher. I'm sure that everybody knows this. But we have five important sections in Section 231. The negotiation and signing of all international agreements is the responsibility of the national executive. So whenever we consider what role Parliament could play, we must remember that the Constitution says quite clearly, negotiation and signature is the responsibility of the executive. Now, how that should be interpreted, whether that allows room for Parliament, is a question that we can discuss. Section 2 and 3 are important because they distinguish between two types of agreements. Agreements which are merely technical, administrative, or executive in nature, and those agreements which are not merely technical, administrative, or executive in nature. An agreement which is merely technical, administrative, or executive, or doesn't require ratification or accession, must be tabled before Parliament only. Other types of agreements that require ratification or accession or are not merely technical, administrative, or executive, must be approved by resolution in both Houses of Parliament. So there's a slightly different procedure here. And then finally we have Section 4, which says that certain treaties can create obligations that are immediately effective on South African territory. In other words, that a South African court can apply that treaty without any additional legislation, South African legislation required. You could call those self-executing provisions of agreement. And subsection 4 of Section 231 says that these self-executing provisions are immediately applicable in South Africa without the need to pass additional legislation as long as they're not inconsistent with the Constitution or another Act of Parliament. So we can see that because of Section 231(4), certain provisions of certain treaties can be directly applied on South African territory without the need for explicit legislation authorizing a court to apply those provisions. This is another reason why Parliament should be concerned and interested in how treaties are negotiated and what they say. Because it's quite possible that South Africa could negotiate a trade agreement which would affect the lives of a street trader directly.
And parliamentarians, as the representatives of the people, should know what the people they represent are going to be subject to. Self-executing provisions are an example of international legislation applying directly on South African territory. Now, the next issue I want to highlight is to look at how South Africa makes its treaties now. And here, as I said, a person like me knows very little. I'm relying here on a paper by Mr. Ahmad, who I think is a parliamentary official, although he wrote this paper in a private individual capacity. And he does something very interesting. He says we can only find out how South Africa negotiates treaties by looking at court cases that have examined how South Africa made treaties. And he refers to an extradition case called Quadliana that came to the Constitutional Court. He explores how an extradition agreement, an agreement that allows suspects wanted for crimes in the United States to be sent from South Africa to the United States. He says that the negotiation process started with preparatory discussions between officials of the United States and South Africa in May 1998. The agreement was ratified on the 2nd of November 2000 in NCOP and published in the National, in the Government Gazette in 2001. It shows that it took 3 years from discussion and negotiation to publication of the treaty. It shows that staff from DIRCO were involved, but that the primary drivers were the Department of Justice. That is, the department concerned with substance of the treaty, in this case extradition. This is the most important. Parliament's role in this process was limited to a discussion in the relevant committee, and then a simple motion was passed in both houses to ratify the agreement. And then the instrument of ratification was signed by the acting Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, and then published in the Government. Now, to understand further what happens in practice, what is publicly available is a 2007 practical guide and procedures for the conclusion of agreements, which comes from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. And I make the following comments under correction, because I know representatives of that office are here, so they can perhaps tell us if this document has been amended. But what you can see there is spelled out in detail what happens internally between the presidency, between the substantive department concerned, the state law advisors, in order for this agreement to enter into force. For the purposes of this discussion, what is most important is that, well, I'll read it to you. The line function department, together with the state law advisors, international law, determine whether the agreement falls under the scope of Section 231(2) or Section 231(3) of the Constitution. Now, for honorable members, this will be important because it suggests that the decision about whether an agreement is merely technical, administrative, or executive, or whether it requires parliamentary approval, will be a decision of the line function department together with the state law advisors for international law. Mr. Ahmed's conclusions in his paper are very, very important for us to consider here. Parliament's role in the foreign policy decision-making process is virtually absent. Even parliamentary debate between the ruling and opposition parties on matters of foreign policy tends to be limited, with one or two exceptions. Now, we can find all sorts of reasons for this. We can think Parliament is busy. We could think that the ruling party and the opposition parties care more about local issues than they do about foreign policy. They're happy to leave foreign policy to the executive. We each have our own thoughts about why it is that Parliament plays such a limited role. I'm not really here to explore that, neither am I in a position to give an expert opinion on it. What I can do is share with you how other parliaments become involved in the negotiation and the implementation of international agreements. Now, in this area, there is very little research. I was able to find a study from 1994 that compared developing and developed countries, but with a clear northern and western bias. So they looked at Brazil, Argentina, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, and Italy. The study is useful because it compares countries that come from a Roman Dutch tradition, a common law tradition, a civil law tradition, and it looks at all of them. The study's authors draw the following three general conclusions. In all cases, they say, that is in every one of these countries, developing, developed, regardless of the type of legal system, the legal tradition the country comes from, in all cases, during the initiation and negotiation phase of a treaty, there is an informal process in which the executive consults with the leaders of parliament. Now, in almost all of these countries, the constitutions of this country say negotiation is the responsibility of the executive. That doesn't stop an informal process of negotiation with the leaders of parliament. There is another example from one country where members of parliament are invited to serve on the treaty negotiation team. That's one possibility we can look at. The other two general conclusions the study's authors draw are less useful, but it's important that I explore them because these were their general conclusions looking at all these different countries. In some countries, the relationship between parliament and the executive is antagonistic, is confrontational, more so than it is in South Africa at the moment. In these countries, countries like the United States, for example, if Parliament doesn't want a self-executing provision to be applied on the territory of that country, they will simply quickly act to adopt inconsistent legislation. Remember that Section 231(4) of the Constitution says self-executing provisions in treaties are binding in South Africa immediately unless they're inconsistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. So some parliaments in other countries of the world say, right, we will adopt inconsistent legislation to block the effect of this treaty because we don't think it's right for our people. Now, the fact that the South African Parliament has that power is clear from Section 231(4) of the Constitution, but Parliament doesn't exercise that power now, so far as I'm aware, because the relationship between the legislative and the executive branches of government in this country are not characterized by such a high degree of confrontation. I would imagine that in South Africa the matter would be settled more politely between the two branches of government, I'm not sure. Another way in which parliaments shape the negotiation of treaties has to do with the exercise of their budgetary power. In many countries, the executive negotiates the agreement, but the money to implement it comes from parliament. Or the money that the executive needs for some other purpose comes from parliament. So in some countries, again, where there is this confrontational relationship, parliament will say to the executive, we will not give you the funds you want for this project unless you negotiate this treaty in that way. So there's a clear use of financial pressure. Now, the next example I'd like to look at in more detail is Canada. The reason for that is simply because the Canadian parliamentary system served in some ways as a model for ours. And the Canadian Constitution also served in some ways as a model for ours. I'm not suggesting that we should blindly imitate other countries. Only that if there is something to learn, let us learn it. If not, we can leave it. In Canada, Parliament, on paper, has less of a role in the making and implementation of treaties than in South Africa. The executive has an even greater role on paper. But in 2008, the government decided that Parliament should have a greater role. And they made this decision largely for reasons of democratic accountability. Because they realized that the person on the street in Canada, in Montreal, in Toronto, is worried about how the WTO negotiations are going. They care about it. And it's not sufficient for Parliament to sit back and say, it's not our business. You will know better than me if someone living in Eastern Cape in a rural area, for example, or someone who lives in a city tower block in Gauteng is worried about how South Africa conducts its international relations. Do they only care that they have a salary, that they have a house, that they have food? I can only offer my own opinion, which is not even a scholarly opinion, it's a human opinion. No matter the level of formal education, no matter the socioeconomic background, there is a realization in the world, among all people, that what happens in other countries affects us, and what we do affects them. Someone who has never left their village will understand the suffering of someone in Darfur. I think in their heart they care. But you know, as honorable members, you know what people care about. If you think they care about how South Africa conducts its international relations, it's important that Parliament steps up and plays a greater role. What do they do in Canada? All treaties between Canada and other states will be tabled in the House of Commons, that is the equivalent of the National Assembly, before ratification, with a memorandum explaining the primary issues at stake, subject matter, obligation, national interest analysis, policy considerations, federal-provincial relations issues, implementation issues, and a description of the types of consultations the government has already undertaken. The House of Commons is then given 3 weeks, 21 sitting days, to consider the treaty before the executive takes action. The Parliament in Canada debates the treaty and passes a motion where they say, we recommend that the executive adopts this agreement, or we don't recommend that it does. It's not binding on the executive. It respects the executive's constitutional power to negotiate agreements. But it adds moral authority and weight to the decision of the executive. Or it withholds it when Parliament says, you know, we respect that the executive can negotiate agreements, but in this case, we don't think this treaty is in South Africa's national interest. Or, we don't think this treaty is in the world's interest. Now, this memorandum that they have in Canada is very similar to what I understand is already prepared in South Africa, where the line function department has to prepare a memorandum which has to be tabled in Parliament. I don't know if these memoranda are read. I don't even know if they're always prepared. You will know that much better than me. Now, another example from Canada about what Parliament could do is to hold public hearings before treaties are ratified and become binding on South Africa. In Canada, they did this with trade treaties because we know in the North, often, whenever there is a WTO negotiation, we see on TV people are protesting and burning things and shouting and screaming about the injustice that they perceive in those trade negotiations. Parliament in Canada decided we will hold public hearings to allow the people to have a voice. And that's another example of what could be done. There's a few other examples. Delivering non-binding treaty negotiation mandate to the executive, where the Parliament might say, when you negotiate this particular treaty, please remember that Parliament is concerned about the following aspects in particular. Monitoring negotiations of treaties, the executive has to answer questions in Parliament. Some of those questions could be about, how is this treaty negotiation going? Why are we adopting a defense treaty with this country whose human rights record would violate almost every provision of our constitution? Doesn't that make us look bad? For example, communicating with the public. Parliament is the voice of the people and is closely connected to the people through constituency work. and exercising due diligence in the passing of international legislation. Sometimes when South Africa's Parliament passes legislation that implements the treaty, that legislation, with all due respect, is considered by lawyers and courts not to be of the best quality. I'm sorry to say, but there are some examples, particularly in the treaty that implemented the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, where there are gaps in the legislation. And if Parliament goes quickly to just approve the legislation so the treaty can come into force, without reflecting on it, without analyzing it closely, the country is worse off. Now, I'd like to conclude with the following suggestion, that there is an area of practice which is open to Parliament and is fully consistent with the Constitution that would allow Parliament to play a greater role in monitoring the negotiation of treaties, the implementation of treaties, and to go through three reasons of public policy which I suggest to you are reasons for Parliament to think about enhanced parliamentary oversight. The first is the increasing domestic impact of international agreements, including on individual rights. Treaties on crime control, for example, adopt common definitions of crimes among many different countries. They said again, trafficking in persons is defined this way. Drug trafficking is defined that way. Crimes against humanity are defined this way. And those definitions of crime affect South Africa, because now their conduct, if they do any of these things, as defined in that particular treaty, they will find themselves being extradited, or not even extradited, being transferred without an extradition process to an international court. So we realize that treaties in areas of human rights, in areas of trade, in many other areas, affect the individual rights of South Africans. So that's one reason for Parliament to be concerned and to be involved. The second is to preserve checks and balances. The legislative authority in the Republic and the executive authority in the Republic don't need to be always fighting with each other. That's not what I'm suggesting. But they watch each other. They make sure, each makes sure that the other doesn't overstep the bounds and take for themselves too much power that could become undemocratic. Finally, and this is for me as an international lawyer the most important reason, international organizations like the United Nations and many others do not really have democratic accountability. Nobody votes. I don't have a vote to say who should sit on the Security Council. You know how they decide who sits on the Security Council? It's like trading cows. You give me this fat cow, next year I give you two fat cows. As an individual in South Africa, I have no say. These international organizations, WTO, the UN, others, don't hear the voice of people in a democratic way. If they don't hear that voice directly, let them hear it indirectly through their parliament. So, Nkosi Ndikumamela Namhlanje.
Thanks very much, Salim Chafani. Before we continue, we'd like to welcome members that joined us in the House Chair, Makanda, that joined us. Now, in the interest of time, and so that we go in the same graph, we'll ask the department to do a presentation so that when we engage with questions, it will be just one off. So, Tiko, this is the opportunity. Thank you. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of Parliament, ladies and gentlemen, allow me to first introduce myself. My name is Sivu Makungo. Up until recently, I was the Principal Federal Advisor at the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, and I've since moved to a different division responsible for East Africa. But I'm here in capacity as a representative for the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, for which I still work for. We've been requested to give a presentation to you, Honourable Members of Parliament, on conclusions of international agreements, the process which will follow. Mr. Salim has touched upon the legal aspects pertaining to the Constitution itself for international agreements and has touched upon some of the processes that will follow. So part of this may seem to be a repetition, but nonetheless, it may be a necessary repetition. So to start off, definition of international agreements. International agreements include any written agreement between South Africa and another state or international organization, and that is governed by international law, whatever its designation. You've heard already that international agreements could be designated as conventions, could be designated as memorandum of understanding, and so on. Whatever its designation, the intent is there. Necessity for international agreements. International agreements are tools to which international relations are given substance and obligations created between parties thereto. They are example of an expression of cooperation with other states. They increase interaction between states, and they increase the need for regulation. International agreements are source of international law. They are basis for international rule-based system, and they pass on legally binding obligations between states. International agreements are an indispensable part of an architecture of international relations. They apply regulatory regimes to the benefit of such states, their populations, and humanity in general. Respective members of international community participate in this regime through international relations, or rather where international agreements are negotiated. Bilateral agreements deal with a wide number of subjects. Example, we have cooperation in areas such as health, sports, education, mutual legal assistance, extradition, double taxation, defense, and protection of investors. Now, with respect to multilateral treaties themselves, now, let me just draw the difference. Bilateral will be, of course, between two states. Multilateral, between more than two states. Multilateral treaties may establish international organizations, such as the UN, which you've heard about, that was established through a multilateral treaty, the Charter of the United Nations, African Union, which was established through a multilateral treaty, the Constitutive Act of the African Union, SADC Treaty, Southern African Customs Union, European Union, International Civil Aviation, and so on. Multilateral treaties also create international cooperation regimes, example, on the safety of air transportation, civil aviation convention, a convention on suppression of unlawful seizure of aircraft, telecommunications. You could have, as well as you mentioned, the Vienna Convention on Treaties themselves, which indicates exactly how treaties will be entered into. Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which regulates how we deal with diplomats here in South Africa and how our own diplomats are dealt with in their countries of station. Treaties aimed at combating terrorism, suppression of acts of nuclear terrorism, as an example. The next one.
What is the importance of international agreements for South Africa? South Africa participates in a wide range of treaty regimes which are all directly related to its foreign policy objectives. We enter into treaties in order to enhance national interests. We take serious our obligations and ensure that we must be able to give effect to the international obligations which are contained in the treaties that we as a country sign and ratify. And when you've entered into a treaty and ratify it, it offers you an opportunity to gain influence in the implementation and management of that multilateral treaty by participating in the governing structures so created to advance your national objectives. Again, a typical example, we are members to the United Nations Charter. That gives us a basis to be a member in the General Assembly of the Charter, to be a member also in the Security Council, as, for example, right now South Africa is vying for the non-permanent seat of the Security Council and is lobbying once the Security Council is reformed for a permanent seat in the Security Council. Further reason why it's important for international people to South Africa. We obtained the opportunity to ensure that our national values, such as promotion of multiculturalism, human rights, are reflected in the text of the treaty. An example of this has also been mentioned by Mr. Salim, the international statute on the criminal court called the Rome Statute. We ratified that, and we passed legislation specifically because we saw within this treaty a process by which our own national values could be upheld. The importance, again, further importance, in negotiating of treaties and implementation process, South Africa builds alliances with like-minded states and states which are members of regional groupings such as SADC, the African Union, the Non-Aligned Movement, G77, and China. We are able to harvest the advantage of regional positions in these negotiations. In many negotiations, particularly multilateral negotiations, you are only able to prevail, in your view, if you're able to form alliances. And through forming alliances with SADC, AU, NAM, G77, and China, we are able to ensure that we gain the upper hand in terms of the negotiations that we've been making with developed countries. So, we invest considerable energy in areas related to Africa's foreign policy priorities, which are inextricably linked to our national interests. Now, some of the major treaties that South Africa has negotiated since 1994 include, as I mentioned, the Constitutive Act of the African Union, the protocol relating to the establishment of the Peace and Security Council of the African Union, the Treaty of the South African Development Community, and the African Charter on Human and Civil Rights. And decisions to enter into agreement, we touch upon this, rest with the line function government department. Now, why is this the case? Why does this rest with the line function department? It goes back to the part where we say that the basis for international agreement is really regulating relationships. And so the line function department, for example, that is responsible for trade, will make the policy decision that in order to facilitate our trade between our South, for example, and Zimbabwe, we need a protection of investment agreement in order to protect African investors that go to Zimbabwe. They have the comparative advantage of knowledge in making that decision. And so it rests with them. It rests with that line function department. question has been raised as to whether entering into treaties is it a loss of sovereignty. Now that is an answer, and I agree with the answer that Salim gave, that in fact the process of entering into international agreement itself is an act of sovereignty. Now, the reason why the question is raised whether it's a loss of sovereignty is that once you've entered into an international agreement, you subject yourself to the obligations arising from the international agreement. So you at least you open yourself to scrutiny. And so you cannot easily withdraw without suffering political retribution for such withdrawal once you open yourself to that scrutiny. So that's why some raise this question whether haven't you given up a level of sovereignty by doing that? And you find that if you look at nations, international agreements are mostly entered into by democratic nations, whereas repressive governments, and that example was mentioned here, Mr. Salim, that prior to 1994, the apartheid government had no interest whatsoever into entering into international agreements because of the scrutiny that it brings up. Whereas democratic governments, for transparency's sake, they enter into international agreements. Not necessarily as a loss of sovereignty, but as an affirmation of their sovereignty and that they wish to be transparent for anybody to be able to see and scrutinize that which they do. I say it's an act of sovereignty because treaties are entered into on the basis of consensus by states and treaty-making powers. Conclusion of a treaty by a state is therefore an act that is performed on the basis of the statement of sovereignty. And states are legally obliged to give effect to the obligations in treaties which imply a limitation of their freedom of action in the international sphere. So those states who enter into treaties, they voluntarily agree to limit their rights in a specific area, which in itself is a sovereign act. The executive authority. Also, it's been mentioned in terms of Section 2311 that our Constitution provides that the responsibility of negotiating and signing all international agreements rests with the National Executive. And then it's also been indicated that there's two further provisions in there. One provision, Section 2312, provides that, however, agreements that will require ratification, those agreements must be subjected to Parliament. And then there's another level, agreements of the technical, executive, and administrative nature, which do not require ratification and do not therefore require submission to Parliament, but may only be tabled to Parliament. And international practice shows that states act in international arena by means of the executive arm of government as the institutions representing the state. A state constitutional arrangement will determine the role Parliament plays in conclusion of treaties. In many states, Parliament has no role and treaty making is an exclusive executive prerogative. Some constitutions assign an oversight role to Parliament, as we have in terms of Section 2311. Now, let's go to circumspections in treaty making. Again, Mr. Salim had reference to what appears on our website. It bears repeating. The process which South Africa undertakes in treaty making is the following. The Land Function Department determines needs depending on government priorities. They identify the cooperation opportunities, advantages that other states may offer to meet, example, health, education, etc. The Land Function Department identify the need to become part of the multilateral regulatory framework in consultation with the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. And then they enter into negotiations, and sometimes those negotiations are protracted. The Department of International Relations play a coordinating role. Now, this is particularly true in respect of bilateral agreements. So the Department of Health will make a decision that they will wish to enter into a health cooperation agreement with country A. They will then approach the Department of International Relations and say, please make contact for us with country A because we wish to enter into agreement with country A. The Department of International Relations and Cooperation plays that coordinating role to make sure that country A's health authorities meet with South Africa for them to begin the negotiation process of the agreement. Once they've negotiated the agreement, and then they come back to the department for the department then to certify whether this agreement that they've negotiated will meet the legal requirement for entry into force. And then the Department of International Relations will do the certification process as to whether the agreement is necessary legal requirement and submit to the president. So South Africa's positions are developed by nine function departments responsible for the subject matter of the international agreement. Consultation with stakeholders does take place, and the line function department is the one, however, that determines the level of consultation with the stakeholders. In some instances, cabinet approval is obtained for positions to be taken at multilateral negotiations. I can again quote an example where I was directly involved when we negotiated the Treaty on the International Criminal Court. The process of negotiating that treaty, the line function department was the Department of Justice, but nonetheless, we had various stakeholders. The Department of International Relations and Cooperation was involved. The Department of Defense was involved because we had an issue pertaining to war crimes and so on. And then a decision was made that as part of the process of negotiation, we must obtain ongoing mandate for cabinet. And so a number of cabinet memorandums were done during the process of the negotiations, which started back in 1994 and only ended in 1998. So it's the nine function department then who makes the call that this is the level of consultation that is required and which stakeholder will be consulted. Now, how can South Africa influence the terms of the treaties? Now, treaties are concluded on the basis of consensus, sometimes adopted by majority voting. It's important to clear positions before conclusion, and there are reservations which are possible to treaties. Such sort of reservations sometimes unusual, in fact, baffling, and sometimes very complex. Some states will provide interpreters declaration. Reservations are possible unless prohibited by the treaty specifically. A treaty provides only specified reservations may be made. Reservation is incompatible with the object and purpose of the treaty. So reservations are possible except under those provisions where the treaty prohibits it, where the treaty limits it, or where the reservation itself goes against the object and purpose of the treaty. And the process as well of making a reservation is determined by the land function department. The land function department will indicate exactly which reservation they will want to make on a treaty. In multilateral arenas, you will have treaties, for example, which will attempt to excuse those countries that apply the death penalty. In respect of those treaties, South Africa customarily will enter reservation. They will indicate that we do not apply the death penalty. And so if it ever comes to a process of extradition, we will not be extradited to a country that applies the death penalty. In some instances, you could have Parliament suggesting that a declarative interpretation be made because the process of reservation in event becomes to Parliament, and Parliament can say, well, in respect of this, we would want a declarative interpretation to this treaty. Or Parliament can refer the treaty back for formulation of declarations or reservations if it deems it appropriate. Now, South Africa has in the past entered into reservations of treaties. We've entered into reservation of treaties in respect of the protocol against smuggling of migrants by land, sea, and air, preventing the United Nations Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime, on the protocol to the African Charter on Human and Civil Rights, and that charter on human and civil rights, the reservation which we made had to do with the issue of death penalty, where we wanted to make clear that South Africa is totally against the death penalty. And the other part we wanted to make clear, because they had a provision there in respect of marriage, that for marriage to be recognized, it must be written. We had a reservation indicating that we recognize non-written marriage based upon customary practice. Now, procedure for concluding agreement. We've mentioned that in the Constitution we have two provisions of interest. Let me just say three. We have the first one, which we mentioned, 2311, that the responsibility lies with the National Executive for negotiating and signing international agreements. And then you have Section 2312, which provides that agreements which need approval for ratification, those must be approved by Parliament. And these agreements, usually, what are these agreements? Usually these agreements are multilateral agreements. In fact, all multilateral agreements have to be subject to Parliament for ratification process. The agreement which we make a determination as the department and the line function department as to whether should we go to Parliament or not, a bilateral agreement. And the simple reason is that by their very nature, bilateral agreements are regulating government-to-government relations. Now, rarely do they have legal binding effect on the person in the street. But they will affect the life of the person in the street. Although they do not have, let me make an example again about the protection of investment as in the trading industry, because I had the Department of Trade and Industry was invited around. The Department of Trade and Industry, for example, took a decision that they will have moratorium on protection of investment treaties. They took this decision because what they found was that in the attempt to make sure that there was inclusiveness in South Africa in mining, they came up with a new law, the Mineral Resources and Energy Act, which provided for mineral rights to revert to the state, so that the state can be the one that provides licenses and so on. Because you had a number of companies, some foreigners, that had 100-year mineral rights. And they were doing that in order to positively affect the citizens. Now, those companies that had these rights, they lost money in the international stock market, because all of a sudden now, those rights on which many of their investments were based on had now reverted to the state. And so what did they do? They picked up their protection of investment treaties that they had and sued the government. You know about the Italian South African arbitration matter, for example. Now, that's an example of a bilateral agreement directly affecting citizens. So the Department of Trade and Industry decided we are going to have a moratorium on these and look at them. But then, later on, South Africa wanted to make sure that our neighbor, Zimbabwe, as things are changing, South Africans begin to invest back in Zimbabwe. Now, South Africans were saying, we're not comfortable with going and investing in Zimbabwe because how do we know our investments will be protected? We just saw land being seized, threats to companies being seized, and so on. And so then again, you have citizens who feel affected by a call that is made by government, and the only way to allay that is you need a bilateral agreement. So the Department of Trade and Industry then makes a decision, notwithstanding the existence of this moratorium, we're going to make an exception with regard to Zimbabwe and negotiate a bilateral investment protection agreement with Zimbabwe, which they have done. And now the process is the process of entering into force. Zimbabwe wants to take that to Parliament, but I suspect our Parliament honourable members may not necessarily have been involved in that process, because again, this is the purview of the National Executive. The Land Function Department will on its own decide if it needs to consult with Parliament on the issue. To the extent that the agreement does not require ratification, it may not necessarily come to Parliament unless you call for it. So, you then have Section 2313, which this is where we make the determination. Section 2313 says that agreement of a technical, administrative, or executive nature. Those which do not require ratification of session. Those which have no extra budgetary financial implications. Those that do not have legislative implications. Those do not have to go to Parliament. And that is the majority of agreements. Those are the bilateral investment agreements. Those are the health cooperation agreements. Those are, you name them, almost every bilateral agreement with countries. Unless that bilateral agreement will require us as a government to come to Parliament to ask for money. If we need not come to Parliament to ask for money, we need not be consulting Parliament. Basically, that's the general interpretation you can provide to 2313. If we need not come to Parliament in order to pass the legislation to implement that agreement, then we need not be consulting Parliament. And that is 2313. And the majority of agreements that South Africa enters into are bilateral agreements, and so by their nature, they fall under 2313. And so not all international agreements require legislation to become binding on South Africa. Only those that affect the rights of South Africans have budgetary implications or have regulatory effects that need to be implemented as part of a multilateral framework need to be included in legislation. And so all of those which need to be included in legislation will then come to Parliament. An example of a bilateral agreement that will bring to Parliament, for example, will be an extradition agreement or a mutual legal assistance agreement. So the legal division, with regard to access to treaties, the legal division has a treaty division. The legal division of JERICO has a treaty division, which provides a dedicated information service. All queries are treated as high priority. The South African Treaty Register is available electronically on the department internet. Mr. Salim spoke about the department's internet, and some of the information he's been able to obtain from there. I invite honorable members to browse that site. You have full text PDF images of the agreement, which are available, dating back from 2005 to 2010. Agreements prior to 2005 are scanned and uploaded continuously. So you will see a list of bilateral and multilateral agreements containing basic information such as date of signature, title of agreement, entry into force, dates available on the JERICO website. You will see guidelines on the conclusion of agreements and the binding practice in South Africa, are also available and also distributed to national departments in hard copy format. Last slide deals with bilateral treaties that we have, which are currently in force. There are currently 1,572. Multilateral treaties which we have, which are in force, 334, the total is 1,906. Bilateral treaties signed but not enforced, 683. Multilateral treaties signed but not enforced, 229. Now, I know the knee-jerk reaction of an oversight committee is probably to run to the part which says not yet enforced. And the usual question is, why is it that you signed this and you're not yet enforced? Let me answer that right off the bat. You had the process of entering into agreement. Let me start with multilateral agreement. The process of negotiating multilateral agreement, let me make again an example which has been mentioned here, International Criminal Court. You have a government or group of governments saying there has been gross human rights violations, commission of war crimes, and so on around the world. Since then, we've set up the criminal tribunal for Yugoslavia. We set up the criminal tribunal for Rwanda. We cannot continue in this way where we set up criminal tribunals ad hoc. We need a permanent criminal tribunal. So they make a presentation and make a resolution to the UN that let's begin to negotiate an international criminal tribunal. In this case, you had one government doing this, which was Trinidad and Tobago, President Robinson. The G8 agrees, yes, let's negotiate it. So the negotiation begins to happen in the material arena. That negotiation can be protracted. South Africa decides to enter the negotiation process. It identifies the land function department to lead based upon the subject matter, so it identifies justice because it has to do with courts and law. Department of Justice then determines which other stakeholders should join the negotiation team. So they say, Dirko, you join. Defense, you join in. And so that becomes the delegation. Then they decide which positions they're going to take. They take those positions to cabinet and ask for cabinet to endorse those positions that they will take. These negotiations unfold, unfold, unfold. They come to a point where it's now a diplomatic conference, where it's going to be the final week of negotiating this. At the end of that week, that treaty is going to be ratified, it's going to be signed. So before the delegation goes back to cabinet and says, here is the draft text we're going to be negotiating. Do we still agree with these positions? Please give us full power that if these positions are adopted, we may be able to sign. Cabinet gives full power through the foreign ministry, so the delegation goes. In hand, it has full powers to sign. The negotiations proceed. At the end of negotiation, the delegation has 8 out of 10 of what it wanted. It has the full power. It decides that notwithstanding that it does not have all of what it wanted, it mandated, but nonetheless it has enough to sign as already mandated. So it signs. Then it comes home after signing, and cabinet may decide, sorry, the 2 that you did not get were the most important, so we don't think we're going to enter into this treaty anymore, although we've given you authority. That's an example of some of the treaties which we've not ratified or entered into force, and cabinet decides it will not even bother to pass it on to parliament for ratification process. So it ends there, that treaty. The Land Functions Department has decided not to proceed at all, so it ends there, that treaty. Now, that was not the case, however, with the International Criminal Court. As you all know, it then came to Cabinet, and Cabinet said, before it goes to Parliament, let it go with the implementing law, rather than simply send as well the implementing law. So we go back and quickly draft the implementing law, and on drafting the implementing law, we get criticized by good jurists that there are gaps and so on, but nonetheless, you end up being the first country in Africa with an implementing law and all the other countries start copying your implementing laws with all those gaps. So that is the process for multilateral treaties. So although there may be some that have not been ratified, a number of them were not worth ratifying to start with, because we did not get all that we aimed to get. And so the Land Function Department is of the view that they're not going to proceed with it. And then, of course, you have a number of them which, although we signed and have every intention to ratify, it's no use, particularly for countries such as South Africa, Land Function solves this, to proceed to head towards ratification until you have everything in place in order to implement the agreement. And so first they start, and that may take time. That's why honorable members, you may ask the question, but you signed this in 1997, and we're only seeing it 10 years later. That's because some of them have expensive obligations. Where if you do, for example, a treaty on standards of imprisonment, where you have to improve your prison cells, you have to indicate exactly, improve how many people may be in one cell and so on. And so some of them have all these expensive obligations where the Land Function Department may say, in order to implement this properly, we need first to set our house in order. And so it does take that time. And so you have those. And then you have some which may just fall through the cracks. Nobody could identify the department that will have to implement and coordinate its implementation. This was the case with one very important one, one of the United Nations Conventions on civil, economic and social rights. And now they found that department, so that will be done. And then with respect to bilateral, with bilateral agreements, you have bilateral agreements which sadly some are entered because the one country wanted to enter it into it for photo opportunity but had never had the intent of carrying it forth. You may have, for example, a visit to President is going to China. In China, the Chinese present an agreement to the president of one nature, where they indicate that they will either provide doctors to South Africa, and that agreement is subject to ratification by their parliament. But then what happens is that they just do not have the capacity to provide, and so they do not never proceed towards ratification of the agreement. So you have a number of those as well. And so the number where it says agreement signed and not ratified or not entered into force, a large number of them fall in that category. So maybe I'll stop there and then if there's any questions. Thank you, Honourable.
Yeah, and I want to hand over to Honorable Mufokeng. I think before he's there, let's give the both presenters a good round of applause.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Gamete. Honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, let me also take the opportunity to thank Mr. Makingo and Mr. Salim for their thought-provoking presentation. I will now open the floor for engagement, questions for clarity, and comments. The floor is now open. Honorable Mobu. So I start at the back there, and then in that order. Honorable member there at the back, and then Honorable Sisa, and then Honorable Mobu, in that order.
Thank you very much. My first question is around treaty making and negotiation. Reference was made to consultation with stakeholders. Can an elaboration be made as to who the stakeholders essentially are, and also out of experience, how has been the interaction with these stakeholders during the treaty making process? Number two is the declarative interpretation. Some of these terms, whilst we may understand the English language, but in this context, we need a better explanation. What is a declarative interpretation? Can you be given some examples of technical, administrative, and executive agreements? I think some mention was made, but the speaker was very fast for us to pick up. Also, the territory register, it said that it's obtained in the intranet. Is that different from accessing it through websites? Because I assume treaties are supposed to be public documents at some stage. But intranet, to me, is a different facility vis-à-vis public consumption. In terms of the status of agreements, I was a little bit lost, obviously, due to my expectations. I'm sorry if I didn't concentrate when the presentation was done, but my understanding is that when these treaties are done, they are signed by heads of state or ministers right at the session when everybody agrees to it. And then thereafter, they are supposed to go to various countries. And once again, the heads of state have got to sign it before it's ratified. Now, with the presentation, I don't pick up exactly what's the status as to how many treaties in South Africa were signed and not ratified. Because amongst other things, one of the things we wanted to highlight is that as people who interact with other countries in various conferences, we have been confronted with this issue of having signed a treaty but not ratified. A very good example is the African Treaty, African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance, a very, very significant and highly profound instrument. And we ask that, why have we not ratified it when a lot of its suspensive issues resonate with our values, constitution, and otherwise? Just as an example. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just two simple questions. I just wanted to find out from the first presenter, Salim, you indicated that the act of ratification of a treaty involves the actual signing of the treaty. But what does acceding to a treaty, what is the actual act that you have to do? Do we just have to take it as a gentleman's agreement? But what is the act? I want to know what the actual act is that is involved. Secondly, what is the highest punitive measure that can be imposed on a country that is found to be in breach of an international treaty? Is there any, what's the highest, other than just maybe slap on the wrist? Thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think definitely the two presentations have been quite a food for thought, and it's quite enlightening. And it shows that ourselves as legislators, we've got quite a big task and a mammoth task ahead of us in trying to make sure that we correct what we have at hand here. I just have a couple of issues that I would like to raise. The first one with Salim, the issue of the domestic impact, trying to individualize the impact of our treaties, because of, I think and I believe that the foreign policy should be an extension of domestic policy. And let me link that with the issue of national interest. The national interest, how are they defined? Who defines them? And what are those? Because of, I believe every country that enters into a negotiation should look at national interest while making sure that they domesticate the impact of the treaties. So for me, there the issue is the issue of how do we make sure that when we enter into this multilateral or even bilateral, for that matter, how do we make sure that the national interests are taken on board to make sure that we domesticate the impact of these treaties. The second one is the issue of sovereignty versus obligation. You see, that is at the heart of the problem, and that is why we haven't yet ratified the Charter on Democracy and Elections, because of often states say, yeah, but I can enter into a treaty, but it's non-binding to myself. So the issue of sovereignty and obligations, how do we make sure that we navigate? Because for me, obligation means accountability, and for me it means implementation, because of why can you enter into a multilateral treaty that you cannot, you know, honor in that effect. And the third one is the issue of the inconsistency with the constitution, because of, I find it quite amusing that why would we want to enter into any agreement that is inconsistent with our constitution. So how do we navigate and make sure that whatever treaty that we enter into takes the parameters of our constitution into effect? And the last one is the issue of the line function. Well, I understand where the department is coming from, but for me, I think that the line function department have got too much power, because of that's why you see there are still some treaties that are not enforced, because of we rubber stamp, they put a gun on our head, we rubber stamp, it goes to the department, it gets stuffed in the shelf. So how do we make sure that when we have acceded or ratified a treaty, it gets to be implemented, notwithstanding those four critical questions when we move forward of how do we make sure that ourselves as legislators take on board the issues of from the ground and filter it through to the agreement, and making sure that whatever agreement we enter into goes back to the ground and making sure that the lives are changed. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me join the queue and welcome the presentations. They are very informative and empowering. The first question is directed to Salim. It's clear that they have done research and a number of countries have been identified and used in that instance. So it's clear that out of the years spent in South Africa and in that comparative study, you have identified the challenges. If you can be a little bit elaborative and deal specifically with South Africa, mainly focusing on how it can obviously improve in terms of making sure that Parliament do play its role when it comes to scrutinizing these treaties. The second one, it's to both of you. I thought you'll go an extra mile and even touch those that are being signed by provincial government and municipalities, because we are talking about the national interest, and the national interests are affecting the very same people they are talking about at provincial level and talking about it at local government level. Then the other one, the third one, is in relation to sovereignty, even though it has been covered. If you can take it further and try to be practical and touch the issue, because whether media or whosoever, when in South Africa we're supposed to be visited by Dalai Lama. It was an issue, and it was said that that was not going to go well with China because of the agreement we have with China as a country. Try to unpack that so that we can be able to understand it in relation to what is being presented today, both yourself and the department. My last question, the fourth one, if you look at slide 12, the last sentence from the department, decision to enter into agreement rests with the relevant line function government department. Maybe take this one and go to the constitution. You go to section 92, you go to number 2. Unpack this one in relation to this one in the constitution, page 57 to be precise. Members of the cabinet are accountable collectively and individually to parliament for the exercise of their powers and the performance of their functions. If you can take this one and link it to what you have presented to us on this one, so that we can be able to be on par, because I am of the view that we are missing each other. There's something wrong. Either my interpretation of this very same constitution is somewhere flawed, or the manner in which it's being presented it has got some shortcomings, or it's my own interpretation of it. I might be subject to some correction. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think mine is, I'm going to be brief, and I think I'll be talking more to myself than to members of parliament. I personally feel that the two presentations are very good, also as enlightenment for the content and the process. The department was presented to us a process which already exists. And as it were, we're talking about reversing some of the perspectives of that process. I think the presenter said it is exclusively the domain of the executive. We want to deal with that issue. That is why we're here. And I think to a certain extent, Professor Salim, you also touched on not really why we should involve Parliament in treaty making, or why we should create room for Parliament in that process, or why we should enhance the role of Parliament in the process. I think you gave us some of the propositions that how Parliament can participate and can be involved. I think those we need to take into account. That is why I'm going to say that on page 11 of your presentation, I think bullet one, to me, is the one that the committee should look at. The one that speaks to the participation of members of parliament in that process. But as to who, what their functions would be, their powers would be, and who's going to elect them into that committee, I think that would be up to parliament. Again, my chairman, in his introduction, gave us four questions which I think are more involved. But again, I still come back to the fact that we have a presupposition there that we must deal with. I think members of parliament know that we have a turnover of more than 62% of members of parliament after every 5 years. You know, it fluctuates. But more members come in. Now, there is we take this for granted every time we deal with issues that members of parliament are familiar with. Now, that is why I was going to say to my chairman that I think the first question ought to be how and why, I mean why and how parliament should be involved in treaty making. Why? We must make a strong case for our participation to the executive. If we want to participate, then we must answer the question, why? And I don't think every member of parliament would be readily answering that question everywhere. So we need to make a strong case for why we need to go into this. My other point is on the issue of sovereignty. I think my brother there, the definition to me would be similar to what comes out of the UN General Assembly's principle on relations governing states. But in practice, then you'd have to deal with other forms of sovereignty. You would have to deal with political sovereignty. You would have to deal with economic sovereignty. I remember when we were dealing with NEPA, when we were negotiating NEPA, there were trepidations about economic sovereignty from other heads of state, African states. And when we were forming the AU, from the OAU to the AU, there were trepidations from the other heads of state regarding political sovereignty. Now, it's not going to be defined as just sovereignty. You have to define economic sovereignty and political sovereignty, because other countries look at it. For instance, the Blanket Act of 1955, probably will know that the UK was involved, Pakistan was involved, Turkey was involved, but the intention was to exclude the US from the oil gas. But today, things have reversed. It is the U.S. which is ruling that gas. So it's also a question of a balance of power that deals with the sovereignty and changes sovereignty. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair, on slide 15, page 15. The presentation by Tico. First bullet says 231, section 2, provides for, and I underline, for approval of certain treaty. And I underline approval. Vis-a-vis what is on page 14. The third bullet, exclusive executive prerogative. To me, that's a contradiction. See, unless approval is rubber stamping. So how do you reconcile those two? Page 18. My problem, I'm not talking like a lawyer, you see, even giving meaning to issues. I'm talking like a politician. Bullet number 2. Departments or consultation with stakeholders, departments would determine the level of consultation. Departments would determine. And I think on next page 19 it says practices vary amongst departments. Does this suggest that it will depend on the mood of that particular minister at the time? Because that's what it means. So if the minister feels very strongly that I don't need to consult, or a DG would say I don't need to consult, why is this not made obligatory if it's going to affect the people? Why is it allowed that it varies? Because it's like it's optional to consult. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question or fear has more to do with what I believe might be termed the nuts and bolts of the signing of these agreements. We know resources are always limited. And my impression is that most of these agreements are not forced on us, but they are initialized by other countries. Say, for example, aviation safety, telecommunication standards, etc. Now, my question is, how can we ensure that there are enough resources, that there are enough innovation for our governments to make sure that we also look at creative new agreements that are not forced on us, but let's say, if I may mention an example, let's say we believe there's an opportunity for South Africa to do trade, improve our trade with Angola. They've got oil, we've got wonderful manufactured goods, and we believe there would be benefit in a special agreement with them. But unfortunately, and that's my fear, and I'm asking the officials to allay my fear, all our manpower, our budget in terms of international travel and accommodation and so on, are already being taken up by these other treaties that we cannot escape from, because you must either go into it or you must be left behind. And that these other ad hoc treaties, the ones that are come from within South Africa, that they are not given enough attention and not enough manpower to bring about. And then the last part of that is also the think tank regarding such treaties. Is there such a think tank somewhere where people come together and say, what would be in the best interest of this country of ours, and what can we investigate? Are there the possibilities of different treaties that might benefit the Southern African region? Thank you.
No, listen.
Thank you, Prokham Derek. Firstly, I just want to go back to section 2312, which says an international agreement binds the Republic only after it has been approved by the resolution in both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, unless it is an agreement referred to in subsection 3, of which the presenter from the department has clarified that, in terms of which are those agreements that fall within that category. I'll try and comment on the first question that deals with the involvement of Parliament during the negotiations process. When you look at the Constitution of South Africa, it deals with the separation of power. There's executive, there's judiciary, and there's parliament, of which it works as a standalone on its own. And my argument would be that since we have a power to approve, that's why we have to come in as parliament. The question is then, therefore, how do we deal with the processes of going through into detail and into content of those particular agreements. But in terms of our own rules, through the committees, the committees have a right to call a person who participated from the beginning in the negotiation of that particular treaty or agreement. And also, it's up to Parliament to approve or not to approve. But at the same time, I think we must also have an understanding in terms of our electoral system vis-a-vis the other countries' electoral systems. Here in our country, our electoral system is based on proportionality. But in some other countries, it's proportionality and constituency, and in others, it's only constituencies. But at the same time, there is an appointment by the president of certain members to participate in that particular parliament. And therefore, I would argue that one, as members of parliament, based on the separation of power, I will argue that we can't participate during the negotiation process. Because immediately, as you use the observer status, in other countries it is interpreted otherwise, but here an observer can participate. Now, if you participate in that negotiation, then how then can you be able to do oversight? Because you are part and parcel of the negotiation. And secondly, the other countries, particularly those that have members that were appointed by the president of that particular country, in terms, when they go there as observers, you'll find that they don't even open their mouth, because the only person who has to say something is the president. I'm saying this based on some of probably the meetings that I have attended, but not particularly where the executive participate. For example, in the Interparliamentary Union, when you are having these debates, you'll find that there will be members who will be arguing based on the constituency representative. Then you can argue for those members to say, okay, fine, they can go and observe, because at the end of the day, before they have a mandate, they have to go to their constituencies. But in our own system, what used to happen is that the political party decides what should be the position. Even when you talk about the National Council of Provinces, the provinces has to delegate the mandate to those delegates. And now, also if you look at that, during the negotiation process, there are min-maps that are taking place, where the national minister will call all the executive members to come and discuss what is it that is there on the treaty. But, of course, I do believe that as portfolio committees, we have a right to at least have public hearings if we want to. To say, okay, to take our people on board, this is how we should deal with this particular issue. Now, on point number, I think it's bullet three, that deals with the fast tracking. I think as Parliament, we should not allow, particularly as committees, we should not allow to be dictated to on how we should do our committee work. If whichever department has tabled, whether it's legislation or whatever, we have to do it on our own terms as the committee. Not that because now it's late and based on that we have to now approve this particular treaty because the delegation has to go now. Based on that, we have to fast-track even the issue of the treaty. I think as Parliament, we need to give the time frame to the department to say, in order for us to approve 1, 2, 3, these things should be tabled in Parliament within a certain period of time, so that we can have our own time as committees to deal with those issues. Now, also when we are dealing with the treaties, when these treaties are tabled in Parliament, it comes with a package of the actual treaties. If there were proposed amendments, it will come also with that one and also with an explanatory memorandum. And then during the briefing, in most cases what used to happen is that either the director general or the chief directors that are responsible for that particular field will come and do the presentation. The question would be, were they part and parcel of the negotiations or not? Now, if they are failing to answer certain questions, then the portfolio committee has a right to say, we want a person who was involved in this agreement from the beginning. And when you have a treaty that then will come with probably the enactment or to come with a legislation. I think also as Parliament, we do have powers there, because in terms of when we are processing the legislation, we are allowed, we have the right to do public participation so that at the end of the day, everybody should be on board. But the only issue is that do we have or do we give that enough space to involve the public in terms of doing their own presentations in terms of those legislation. But I think the only weakest point that we have at the present moment is that when the department drafts or come up with their regulations, we don't monitor those regulations. We don't, I think I can say in most cases, we don't even say before you implement those regulations. It must come to us as portfolio committee or select committee so that we can go through it to see whether the regulations are in line with the legislation that we have passed. I'm raising this because when I was in the National Council of Provinces as a member of a committee, what happened, there were issues that we said they must not be part of that particular legislation. But when the department was drafting the regulations, all those issues came in through the regulations. So I think that's where as committees we need to really focus on. Because in terms of the legislation, we allow that the department may table the regulation. So it doesn't say the department must. Because if you say may, the department can choose whether they can table those regulations to a committee or not. On the issue of some treaties that are taken at a multilateral level, I think what we had as a weak point is that probably the members who are participating at multilateral forums in particular, sometimes they didn't have that opportunity to come back and report and say these were the charters or agreements that were agreed upon at a multilateral level, and then make a follow-up with the relevant committees. For example, if you talk about the African Charter of Human Rights and Democracy, through SADC and also through IPU, we know that there is that charter, and we have followed it up and we are informed that it's with the Department of Justice. But the question is, the relation of those who are serving in those international forums, as parliament to parliament, have they met with either the chair or the management of the portfolio or select committee to say, this is the charter that is within the department, can you follow this one up? so that when we go back, we will be able to say, where is that charter now? I think we have to have that working relations with those who participate in those international forums, with the portfolio committees. And also when it comes to the to these treaties and agreements, I do believe that within the framework, after they have agreed upon, that there is a space where maybe it says after 3 months or 6 months, that particular treaty or agreement should be reviewed. And then that's the opportunity for us as Parliament to say, during the discussion, this is where we're having concerns. So during the review, therefore, we appeal to the Minister to make sure that our concern is tabled for review during the review of that particular treaty. I think by doing that, then we'll be able to say we have participated, but at the same time, I think after we have approved, then we must be able to have a program as different committees to inform the public on saying this is the treaty or the agreement that we have approved as Parliament. This is how it's going to have the impact on individuals at the local level. Thank you very much.
May will be the last one in September, and then we'll give the presenters the opportunity to respond.
Thank you very much, Program Director, and thank you very much for the initiative that was taken for today also, and I also thank the great presentations that we've had this morning. I think we've heard quite a bit that the key role of the legislature, of course, is to check, to challenge, to monitor and legitimize policies undertaken by the state and by implication the executive. And I think in answering the questions that have been put here to us, I think that one of the key things that needs to be addressed in whatever new proposals or any legislative changes or any constitutional changes that we might wish to call for is whether there is sufficient capacity within the institution of Parliament to bring about any change. And I think that is quite important that we have to undertake that. I'm quite interested to find out from our legal friend there that his view on how Namibia is doing all of this. I saw a case study between South Africa and Namibia where this issue was quite central in how do we do this and how do we structure ourselves in Parliament. The South African Parliamentary Committee, it's not me saying this, it's what the study said, was referred to as a mobile committee. And by that they meant that the South African committee bothers itself with visiting very many countries, lots of meetings everywhere, lots of invites and so on, and then of course culminate into millions of reports to Parliament, as opposed to what the Namibians done was they went around to a lot of the missions and they took to the missions their national interests in doing oversight on the national interest in all these commissions. And so that's why I'm quite interested to find out this comparison of the South African Committee and the Namibian Committee and whether there are more case studies in Africa on this question, because I think for me that would be the first one, just how in Parliament are we ready if we want to make any changes to this. The second area that I want to address is, again, in answering the earlier question that has been asked, the question maybe that we should ask is whether Parliament should be involved in the formulation of foreign policy or not. And when I say the formulation of foreign policy, now whether we want to part the treaty and all the other names that we have, whether we think that within the what Section 231 says, whether there is that space for us in there, and I can't speak for the Portfolio Committee on foreign affairs. I can maybe speak a little bit about the trade and industry and give examples of receiving things more than being at the initial stages of any negotiations that goes on. So I think that that's a consideration that we need to give, because I think we won't be involved in the negotiations. We would be mapping quite clearly out for ourselves, this is what we would want to do that, and why would we want to get involved in that? As legislatures, as parliament, what is our interest? Our interest really is to get involved in things like debt relief around the world. Our interest is to get around, to get involved with elimination of poverty around the world. Because those are the things that the voters out there mandate us to come and do here. So they go beyond the borders of South Africa. And so I think that gives us good reason why we should do that. Because that's the common interest, that's the national interest, that's the common good that all of us speaks from. So I would argue that, you know, those, that gives us quite a bit of reason why we should actually be part of some initial stages other than the end ones where we need to accept or reject. We, second lastly also, now I think I've spoken about this issue of beyond the border, but the other reason why I want to give is because we're quite interested in this thing called globalization. Globalization forces us to do a particular thing as legislatures. And therefore, maybe it's quite an important for us to carve out a niche area of the design stage as opposed to the implementation stage only. This is a very, this might sound like a very a sticky issue, but just think about it. I'm not saying we should, but just think about it. Legislatures doesn't get involved in appointing of ambassadors. The question is, should we? If we are interested in the national interest of the country, should we? Well, why shouldn't we? And that's why I think we should unpack what are all the different things that we would like to put into the changes that we would really like to bring about. Because I do think there are limitations. Let's just be honest about it. There are limitations with Section 231 in the way that it has been put, because Parliament's role primarily is around legislation and doesn't necessarily have this big emphasis. But I think in 2010, where we are now, there's more reason for us to focus on international agreements to that part of the Constitution and see how we can do that. For, as I end up, for two reasons. My little experience on the WTO, when a parliamentary dimension was formed, there wasn't much, it's nice to go there. So what did we do? Were we able to, in the WTO, move the party sufficiently to create a dimension in the agreement to move it forward? WTO agreement, we all know, has been dormant for how many years? And then also, if you take the other, you know, there was collapse of the climate change thing in Denmark not too long ago. Same reason. Do we have an instrument as Parliament that will move these negotiations? And that's why I argue, should it be at the end or shouldn't it be at initial stages? I'm sorry if I took too long, but thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks for the opportunity. I'll just be very quick. My point is really around the need, the reasons why government department needs to conclude international agreements. What you find is that many a times departments just go around entering into international agreements without necessarily appreciating the need of why, you know, is it necessary for such an agreement to be concluded. I think a thorough analysis is really required in terms of you know, the specific needs of the particular line function department. And, you know, what are the actual objectives as far as that international agreement is concerned. What you'd find is that, for instance, if I can speak about bilateral investment treaties, most of the times when the DTI concluded this, by the way, my name is Steven Matata from the DTI. Most of the times when the DTI concluded these agreements, they were mainly intended for, you know, investment promotion. But if you really look at the actual substance of the agreement itself, nothing speaks about the promotional aspect of the agreement. Then it's mainly about protection, and you know, the question is protection for who? You know, if you look at an bilateral agreement, it's supposed to be reciprocal. But what you find is that, you know, when a BIT is concluded, it's meant to facilitate investment, you know, vice versa in both countries. But what you find is that, for instance, when we sign BITs with developed countries, most of the investment that comes through is inward, and none of our investors are locally do actually have investment in such countries. So what you find is that there are far-reaching implications as far as dispute resolution mechanisms of these agreements are concerned, for instance, where you find that private individuals are now being given an opportunity to litigate with governments on an international plane, whereas this was like an anomaly in the past, where you would find that generally, in terms of international law, only governments can actually enter into these kind of agreements. But what you find with BITs is that two governments would conclude the agreement, but the actual recipients of the benefits that flow from the agreement itself are private individuals. As you've seen now lately, the government was sued for something like 2 billion rand by some Italian mining investors in terms of the bilateral investment treaty that we have with we have with Italy, as well as the Belgium-Luxembourg countries. And what happened was that South Africa was taken on international arbitration. We spent something like 50 million rand of taxpayers' money simply because these investors didn't like our laws. They just didn't like the BEE laws, which were mainly implemented for fundamental economic and political reasons. And after a long, very long protracted legal battle, we finally managed to come to conclusion of the whole litigation, which was finalized sometime last month. And the final conclusion was that their claims, the investors' claims were dismissed with prejudice, and they were ordered to pay something like 4 million rands in cost. But I mean, that is a drop in the ocean, comparatively speaking, to what the government has spent on taxpayers' money. So my point is that it really becomes critical to look at the substance of the agreement and not just the title itself. The title might look just rosy. When you look at it, you might think that, well, we're signing with, for instance, the U.S., you know, a lot of investment are going to come through. But what you find is that you might actually be, you know, exposing your own legislation to potential, international litigation, which might not necessarily appreciate your own developmental or political reasons why those legislation or policies, for instance, BEE, were actually implemented. So it's very, you know, important that background check really needs to be done by government departments when they, you know, conclude these type of agreements. And after learning a very hard lesson, we embarked on a review of a bilateral investment treaty policy framework, which was recently adopted by Parliament. And out of that, three recommendations were made that we need to establish a national investment law so as to capacitate our own, legal, regime or industry, so to speak. For instance, in this case, we had lawyers representing us all the way from Paris in France. We never had local actual expertise to deal with investment, issues, investment law-related issues. So that's one of the recommendations, so as to empower our own, lawyers in the country in order to make sure that, these kinds of disputes are actually litigated and concluded within the borders of South Africa, and which, greater appreciation of the reasons why, these kind of laws, developmental laws, are actually implemented in the country. And the second,
can you conclude?
Yes, just final point. And the second one is that we terminate future BITs where there might be more risk than benefits in the country. And the last one is to you know, make sure that we conclude this part of agreement on the basis of any political
On a point of order, are you really representing the department?
I am.
You are an observer. Okay, accepted. Can we allow the presenter to respond?
Thank you very much, honorable members. Let me be brief, because there's really a number of questions, but they really fall under two aspects. One is what it is in the Constitution that provides for the role of Parliament, what it is in the Constitution that provides for the role of National Executive, and two, whether both institutions, are they doing their specified role in the manner prescribed in the Constitution. Now, then there's the last aspect, ambitions which Parliament may have, notwithstanding that which may exist in the Constitution, just ambitions which Parliament may have. Now, what you have in the Constitution is simply this. National Executive is responsible for negotiating and signing international agreements. Parliament's role is largely oversight. And then you have those agreements which, in the agreement themselves, require Parliament. The agreement itself says you require Parliament because you require ratification. And so those agreements, all of them, come to Parliament. The next question is Parliament doing its duty in respect to those? Do you scrutinize them properly? Do you ask the relevant questions that are needed? Or do you rubber step them? Now, as an executive, if I know that this agreement I'm negotiating will need to go to Parliament, and there exists a chance that Parliament will reject it, what am I going to do? I'm going to make sure that Parliament is one of the stakeholders. I'm answering the question of stakeholders better. Because I want to make sure by the time it goes to Parliament, it's not rejected. And that is why you have those examples of a number of states which Mr. Salim was talking about. And that's usually in governments where you have a largely competitive parliament, coalition parliament and so on, where the executive knows I will not get the majority of passing this unless these people, I carry them along right from the beginning. And those are the examples, to be frank. Where, however, and Mr. Salim even used hands of clash like this, what's the opposite of the clash? If the executive has a seat at Parliament, I will come to the Parliament only when it's necessary. I hope that answers many of the questions that were raised. So, in terms of the roles that are prescribed currently in Parliament, the executive is doing all, and we advise the executive as lawyers to do all that is required by law to do, for it to do, and it does that religiously. But of course, the issue of political decisions to be made regarding whether, notwithstanding the law, do I go the extra step of consultation and so on, largely depends on whether the executive thinks that at the end of the road, will I get the buy-in or not buy-in. And my suspicion is that the executive knows they will always get the buy-in, and so they will consult only if they need to. And maybe let me close, because I think with that I may have answered a lot of questions. There were issues raised specifically regarding the slides, the consultation with stakeholders, the powers that blind function department has, and so on. Now, we do those again, and those are really, again, within the Constitution. What you have in Article 92, 2, and 3, which places the responsibility of accountability, places the responsibility on members of cabinet to give reports. Now, members of cabinet proceed in accordance with the system that Parliament has in place. And I, as an advisor for a member of cabinet, advise my cabinet principal to proceed with the system that you have in place. That system is, when you summon to provide a report, you can provide a report. When you ask for a question to reply, you provide a reply, and so on. Outside those systems, unless Parliament institutes specific systems, there's nothing else for particular advice advisors to indicate to our principals to do. So Article 92 is, to the best of the knowledge, applied again religiously by the principal. Now, the competition that may apply between multilateral treaties, those treaties which everybody wants us to get into, and those which we decide. Let me say, if you make a comparison, the last slide that we had, if you make a comparison between bilateral and multilateral, bilateral treaties that we have is 1,572, multilateral is 334. Bilateral treaties are mostly initiated by the two governments that wish to enter into them. So South Africa will initiate a lot of those 1,572 bilateral agreements. We will, for example, take a decision that we need to help Rwanda after the genocide, because most of their professionals died, and we say we need to provide Rwanda with medical doctors. However, we need medical doctors ourselves, but Cuba has a lot of medical doctors. So we say, Cuba, we're going to enter into a bilateral agreement for you to give us doctors. We enter into a bilateral agreement for Rwanda. Rwanda, we're going to give you Cuban doctors, and we're going to pay for them. So that is initiated by South Africa themselves. That is just one example. There's numerous such examples. And if you look at the numbers, the largest majority are initiated by South Africa based upon national interest. I'm again trying to answer the question of national interest. The national interest, the land function department that has a responsibility for carrying out and servicing the South African nationals, will decide how it best can service South African nationals, and that becomes the national interest. And then it will say, based upon this national interest, we need scientists from country A. And so they enter into an agreement on exchange of scientific knowledge, an exchange of scientists and so on, based upon that national interest. So again, the land function department that does. But in conclusion, really, if you look at the roles that are currently played by the executive and parliament, both bodies are playing their roles consistent with the constitution. And the consultation that largely happens, you will find that it will happen all of the time when the executive knows that it will need to come to parliament for money, or it will need to come to parliament to pass a law. In those instances, they will make sure that parliament is involved right from the beginning to make sure that eventually they get their money or they get their legislation. Otherwise, they know that in any event, at the end of the day, if it is a suit of parliament, it will be passed. Thank you.
Thank you. My colleague has very incisively dealt with the underlying issues behind some of the questions, but I will try, some specific questions were put to me, I will try to deal with them one by one, but in a time-efficient manner.
First, I apologize that I don't know the names of all of the honorable members, so if I simply say honorable member, please excuse me. But starting with Honorable Mubu, who I had a present opportunity to meet, is he still here? Ah, okay. Well, to mention briefly, he asked, what does it mean to accede to a treaty? How do you do it? It's called an instrument of accession. How do you ratify a treaty? It's called an instrument of ratification. It's usually just a document signed by the relevant minister or by the president, depending on the arrangements in the country. He also asked about how treaty, what happens if you breach a treaty? What's the worst that can happen to you anyway? And the answer to that is that it's largely a matter of which treaty you're breaching. If the worst possible thing that can happen to a country that breaches the UN Charter is that the Security Council can order that military force should be used against it. The worst possible thing that can happen to a country that violates a trade, multilateral trade treaty, is that they can have punitive economic sanctions put on them so that their exports, for example, are not allowed in or are allowed in subject only to customs duties or other payments. The worst thing that happens if a country breaches the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court sounds like nothing. They get reported to the Assembly of States Parties for political action. The treaty says nothing more. So in sum, how bad is it for South Africa to breach a treaty if it ever would consider doing such a thing? It depends on what the treaty itself says. The question of who defines national interest was raised by Honorable Mokgalapa, I think. And it's clear from the statements of my distinguished colleague from the department, on speaking on behalf of the department, that the line function department decides what is in the national interest. I hope that that's a fair statement to reflect that that's what I've understood. Speaking as someone who's made South Africa my home, I think the national interest should be debated in Parliament, quite honestly. Whether Parliament has the final say or not, something else I won't hazard a guess on, but it should be discussed. I think that one way that this can be achieved is that the line function department should be encouraged by Parliament to make their national interest analysis explicit. I'm not sure what the content is. The Honourable Member referred to explanatory memoranda. And I'm not sure exactly what goes into the explanatory memoranda, whether the national interest analysis is in there, whether it's extensive, whether members of Parliament consider that it's extensive enough, or whether they would like to see more. Honourable Mokgalapa also raised the issue of how to balance sovereignty and obligation. And this is a very deep question. It's not easy to answer. All I can offer in this regard is to say that the era of unfettered national sovereignty is unequivocally over. It would be foolish of us to think that it's better not to accept any international obligations so that we don't have these rules that will tie our hands. That is a naive way of thinking. As was mentioned by Honorable September, did I get the name correctly? I'm not sure. Globalization is a fact we have to deal with. A healthier approach to this question of sovereignty versus obligation is to ask, what problem is this treaty trying to solve? Is it trying to solve this problem at a level that is appropriate to the problem? Let me give you a practical example. It's impossible for South Africa to act alone in the area of climate change because air moves. If an international treaty was to say it's an offense to chew gum on the streets of Port Elizabeth, you would say, well, in this case, clearly, it's infringing our sovereignty because the issue of whether you can chew gum in Port Elizabeth should be dealt with by the Port Elizabeth municipality, by the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro. But if the problem that is trying to be resolved is a problem that can best be resolved through international cooperation and common standards, then it's better for South Africa to take on that obligation and that accountability. Because the end of result will be a more efficient international system that is in South Africa's interest. Now, Honorable Nyambe raised the question of how can we improve the role that Parliament plays in its oversight of treaty making and implementation. There's a range of options on the table. many honourable members have raised possible ways this can be done. I would just encourage us to remember that the Constitution sets the markings on the playing field and the rules of the game. It doesn't tell us how exactly Bafana Bafana should play. My distinguished colleague from the department has suggested to us that really the way in which the executive deals with Parliament is a matter of politics. It's a matter of power. If it needs Parliament, it will come to Parliament. It's that simple. Now, how is Parliament going to deal with that? It may be that it could be very useful for the executive in an international negotiation as a negotiating tool to be able to say, you know, I'm sorry, representatives of State A or State B, this provision is not going to go through our parliament. Our parliament exercises serious scrutiny. Really, we need new wording here so that we can make it palatable to our parliament, because our parliament is strong and we respect its wishes. That's an example of how the legislative interest and the executive interest can come together. A stronger role for Parliament gives the executive a new tool in negotiation. That's just one example, among others. This problem is here with the visit of the Dalai Lama. So the Dalai Lama cannot come because of our agreement with China, was the example that was raised. We need to be very careful here, because I don't think there's any agreement with China that says, do not allow a visit by the Dalai Lama. Probably what happened is that South Africa was worried about its reputation with China and its relations with China. If we are not careful and consistent, we may find ourselves saying one thing in multilateral fora, saying things about human rights and so forth, and then when it comes to bilateral agreements, which are government to government and negotiated privately and not even made public to on the website of DERCO, we may be saying something else entirely. If we are not consistent in the messages we send, multilaterally and bilaterally, it becomes like the lizard which eats its own tail. It will come up and it will catch us. Maybe not today, but in the future. So this is a reason to be consistent in our values. I also want to touch briefly on the fact that these treaty negotiations, honourable members have suggested, are subject to the realities of power. The United States can walk into a meeting and say, right, you want this investment? You signed this treaty with this language. South Africa is not so powerful that it can ignore these realities. How can it react? One example is the negotiation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. A negotiation that went against the national interest decisions of the most powerful countries of the world. For that reason, the United States signed the treaty and withdrew its signature. China didn't sign. India didn't sign. Russia didn't sign. Yet, this court exists. It has the support of a great majority of the countries of the world. It's largely seen, of course it has had difficulties, but it's largely seen as a credible, transparent, impartial, more or less, institution that is well respected. And it's been able to hopefully do some good in the world. It did so because South Africa acted in unity with others. It went into the negotiation and said, our national interest here is to be part of a like-minded group of almost some 100 countries, which included north, south, east, west, small, big, powerful, weak, all together. The only response to arbitrary power is unity. Now, there are so many other points that were raised that I'm afraid that I won't be able to deal with them. The question of how to avoid the phenomenon of mobile committees that are using taxpayers' money lavishly. Namibia's example seems to me to be a good one. I didn't know it. And it's worthwhile to study to see what other comparative examples there are from Africa. You know, I use Skype, personally. I know it's not so glamorous and it doesn't involve a red carpet, but there you go. I'm trying to go through and see if there's anything else that I really haven't dealt with yet. Provincial and municipal international relations. I don't touch them in my paper. They are a major phenomenon in South Africa. There's a footnote in the paper that refers to a chapter of a book which I co-authored on provincial and municipal international relations. My limited understanding is that municipalities and provinces love to do international relations, especially municipalities. Most of those international relations don't amount to anything of substance. They're just, toasting each other and having things. But some of them are very significant. Cooperation in the areas of health, environment, cross-border spraying of malaria, mosquitoes, all sorts of interesting things. What I do know, though, is that sometimes the way in which municipalities and provinces conduct their international relations creates headaches for DIRCO. Because those municipal officials or provincial officials, with the best of intentions, go beyond their mandate, maybe even act in a way that's not consistent with the Constitution, and then DIRCO is left with a foreign relations headache when a state comes and says, listen, this city in our country has signed this agreement with your city and you're not doing anything about it. And DIRCO says, well, sorry, actually, they went beyond what they could have said. So, if there's anything that I haven't dealt with, I apologize, I've tried.
Thank you very much. I'll now hand over to Comrade Tulas to give the way forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The advantage of giving the way forward is you put your own summary as the summary of the meeting. Members, there were critical questions which we asked at the beginning relating to enhancing the capacity of the Parliament to scrutinize treaties, whether the accompanying notes or memoranda are adequate, the process of domesticating those international treaties and the scope for early involvement, and I want you to underline that involvement, pre-negotiation, negotiation stage, or just prior to ratification, what would be good. There are different arguments on that. But I think what is emerging, everybody agrees on the issue of democratic accountability, to ensure that is are the international treaties in keeping with the national interest. I know that from the side of international relations, this is a big debate. Even at the level of DIRCO itself, as what is South Africa's national interest. Still a big debate. And it's clear that at some stage we have to plug in. Can Parliament then intervene to ensure that the interests and human rights of the citizens are protected? It comes to that question of approval, disapproval. Do we have the power to disapprove? Has it ever happened that we change something, we say, no, we don't agree? Or when the executive brings to us, it's expected that we must put a stamp, it must go. Then how do we review, if we have to review? The other issue came, the public and parliamentary involvement. How does Parliament give effect to the voice of the people in the negotiation of treaties, whilst they are still being negotiated? Let me use the example of the WTO, whilst I was still a trade journalist. If we were not there as COSATU and in particular teacher unionists, those who were negotiating on behalf of us as the South African government at the WTO in Hong Kong on the issue of services, education and health. They would have given them away. It was as a result of our objection, because we were there. We objected that you can trade on education and health. They wanted to make them to be traded privately and so on. It would mean people would just come into our country, put whatever private, whatever school and so on, the way they want.